This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
In this lecture, we come to the most emotionally gripping argument that can be urged against the Christian faith. I say it's emotionally gripping because even though it may only be a soundbite type of criticism that unbelievers throw out there to very quickly say, well, I don't have to take the Bible seriously. The fact of the matter is that anybody who's a thinking Christian has got to be somewhat perplexed by this. And even if it's not a perplexity that arises from the intellectual or philosophical conundrum of suffering and evil, it may be a perplexity that bothers you, even when you have the answers philosophically, bothers you because of the suffering that you have seen or undergone in your own life. I don't imagine any of us can say that we're totally unaffected when an unbeliever says, well, if God is good and loving, why does he let this happen to you? And we do struggle with that. I do. Some people who know a bit about my biography, and it's not important to go over all that, have had occasion to ask me, in light of certain things that have happened, problems in my family, in my health, what have you, and they'll say, how do you continue to believe in God? And the reason I don't like people to ask that is because it's a real struggle in sanctification sometimes. Although I can say in my own case, and I'm not universalizing this for everybody, but in my own case, I don't think I've really gotten to the place where I didn't think God existed. But there have been many days when I was so depressed spiritually that I wondered if he really loved me. I believed in his love. And I could also believe, because I know my own life, that there'd be every reason for him not to show that love to me. And given the fact that my wife left me, or that I've had open heart surgery, and most recently, the thing that really threw me for a loop was being diagnosed with diabetes. I mean, I just get to the place where actually in tears to say, God, why so much? Well, maybe the answer is that God brings glory to himself by taking utterly ill-equipped and weak vessels and putting way too much strain on them and showing that they survive anyway. Because then you see, he gets all the glory. It really, believe me, if you knew me personally, if you knew the struggles, if you knew the prayers when I cry out to God and the doubts I have, you'd say, it certainly is not because of your religious superiority that you made it. And so, when an unbeliever comes to me and says, how do you expect me to believe in God when my child was killed in this accident? How could God do that to me? I have some intellectual answers for that. But nevertheless, it shakes me because I know what it is to hurt like that, to hurt so desperately you don't know what to say. There comes a point when words cannot say what words cannot say. And so the problem of evil and suffering is a devastating one and can be used very effectively against the Christian faith. Now, sometimes people throw it out there in a somewhat shallow and insincere way. I'm thinking of people who maybe have not had a real hard time in their life. They're getting by real well. They've really known the blessings of God, even though they haven't known the source of those blessings. And then when you bring up, you know, your Christian testimony, try to bring them to the Bible, to the gospel, then it's kind of like a cheap throwaway argument. Well, then why are there wars? You know? Not that their family or they themselves have had a terrible time with that, but it's just kind of a general, abstract, impersonal, well, this should be a perfect world if God exists. It's not a perfect world, therefore God doesn't exist. But some of the people who throw out the argument are not just putting out a cheap criticism saying we should have a perfect world and we don't. They're also putting out a very emotionally gripping thing because they're bitter with God. Or with the God who doesn't exist, they're very angry. When I debated Edward Pavish back a few months ago at the University of California, Davis. In fact, I think Tim read a quote earlier today where Pavish says, if there is such a God, I want to sue him for negligence, for being asleep at the wheel of the universe when he allowed my grandfather and my uncle to be gassed to death at Auschwitz. Now here's somebody, interestingly, who's angry at a being that doesn't exist. You know, what he's angry at, he would say, is you tell me about such a God. I'm angry at this alleged God that you're talking about because this never could have happened if God exists. Now, I'd like to tell you, just because that was a, and he thought, a devastating argument. In fact, he went on to say that not only is it a devastating argument against God that people suffer in this world, but all the more, he said, I cannot believe in a God that tortures people forever in hell. And he got very, very sarcastic about this. He would refer to being sent to the barbecue pit forever for simply not praying correctly or believing something correctly. Of course, that's a total misconception of the Christian view. And the fact that he misrepresents his opponent in getting to his criticism of hell just tells you all the more that this is an emotion-driven argument, not one that comes from analysis, an attempt to be open-minded or fair. He challenged God to show himself that night. He said, if this God exists, he has an opportunity, let him come into the auditorium tonight and show himself. Now, a person who talks that way, so disrespectfully, so emotionally, again, shows that he's not trying to think things through clearly and just cannot come up with an intellectual answer. He doesn't want an intellectual answer. He's angry. Maybe he's hurt. I don't get the hurt side from toddlers in particular, but you'll talk to people who really are hurt. They're disappointed. I've known people who say, I went to church for years, but I just can't do that anymore. There's just been too many things that have happened. I just don't know about this God anymore. So there are people who are hurt. There are people who are angry. By the way, I told Edward Tavish in response when he challenged God to show himself that night, I said, you should be very glad that God hasn't chosen to answer that desire of yours. Because when God appears, we aren't going to be debating it anymore. It's going to be the day of judgment. But what do you say about his grandfather and his uncle who are gassed to death at Auschwitz? How could God allow that sort of thing to happen? My reply, which is the quick bottom line that I want you to learn from the lecture that we're going to get into more detail, my reply was, as a matter of fact, on your way of looking at things, none of us have any complaint about what Hitler did at Auschwitz. You understand what I'm saying? On the atheist approach to things, if there is no God who is eternal, who has an unchanging moral character on the basis of which we can have moral absolutes, if there is no God, then who can condemn Hitler for doing what he did? Because on the atheist, materialistic view of the universe, one animal did what we think are painful things to other animals. But then again, why shouldn't animals be allowed to do whatever they do? Why is there any moral assessment of anything that happens in the universe given the atheist approach? So that ironically, what he thinks is his trump card argumentatively, the thing he can use most powerfully against the Christian faith, turns out to undermine his atheist worldview. Because he cannot hold with moral indignation any absolute moral judgment as long as there's no basis, one, for morality, much less absolute universal morality in the universe. And that's what I'd like you to learn from this lecture, and along the way maybe learn some things about the psychological problem as well. About that psychological problem, let me read for you a portion that I do often in lectures like this from Dostoevsky, the Russian novelist, and the brothers Karamazov. In this portion of the novel, we have Ivan, who is arguing with his brother, Aloysia. Aloysia is a novice preparing for the priesthood, and Ivan has real problems with this. And so we pick up the conversation in the middle. Ivan says, I've collected a great, great deal about Russian children, Aloysia. There was a little girl, 5, who was hated by her father and her mother, most worthy and respectable people, of good education and breeding. You see, I must repeat, again, it is a peculiar characteristic of many people, this love of torturing children and children only. To all of the types of humanity, these torturers behave mildly and benevolently like cultivated and humane Europeans. But they are very fond of tormenting children, even fond of children themselves in that sense. It's just their defenselessness that tempts the tormentor. Just the angelic confidence of the child who has no refuge and no appeal, that sets his vile blood on fire. And every man, of course, a demon lies hidden, the demon of rage, the demon of lustful heat at the screams of the tortured victim, the demon of lawlessness let off the chain, the demon of diseases that follow on vice, gout, kidney disease, and so on. Well, this poor child of five was subjected to every possible torture by those cultivated parents. They beat her, thrashed her, kicked her for no reason till her body was one bruise. Then they went to even greater refinements of cruelty. They shut her up all night in the cold and frost in a privy. And because she didn't ask to be taken up at night, as though a child of five sleeping its angelic sound sleep could be trained to wake and ask, they smeared her face and filled her mouth with excrement. And it was her mother. Her mother did this. And that mother could sleep hearing the poor child's groans. Can you understand why a little creature who can't even understand what's done to her should beat her little aching heart with her tiny fist in the dark and weep her meek, unresentful tears to dear, kind God to protect her? Do you understand that, friend and brother, you pious, you humble novice? Do you understand why this infamy must be and is permitted? Without it, I am told, man could not have existed on earth, for he could not have known good and evil. Why should he know that diabolical good and evil, what it costs so much? Why, the whole world of knowledge is not worth that child's prayer to dear, kind God. And we skip a couple of pages, and he continues with Aloysia. He says, let me tell you, novice, that the absurd is only too necessary on earth. This is tongue-in-cheek. He's making fun now of Christianity. The world stands on absurdities, and perhaps nothing would have come to pass in it without them. We know what we know. Aloysia says, what do you know? He says, I understand nothing. Ivan went on as though in a delirium. I don't want to understand anything now. I want to stick to the fact. And then he continues. You see, Aloysia, perhaps it really may happen that if I live to that moment, the day of judgment has been brought into the conversation, because perhaps it may happen that if I live to that moment, arise again to see it, I too perhaps may cry aloud with the rest, looking at the mother embracing the child's torturer. Thou art just, O Lord. But I don't want to cry aloud then. While there is still time, I hasten to protect myself, and so I renounce the higher harmony altogether. It is not worth the tears of that one tortured child who beat itself on the breast with its little fist and prayed in its stinking outhouse with an unexpiated tear to dear, kind God. He says, and if the sufferings of children go to swell the sum of sufferings which was necessary to pay for the truth, then I protest that the truth is not worth such a price. And then at the end of their conversation, he says, imagine that you are creating a fabric of human destiny with the object of making men happy in the end, giving them peace and rest at last. But it was essential and inevitable to torture to death only one tiny creature, that baby beating its breast with its fist, for instance, and to found that edifice on its unavenged tears. Would you consent to be the architect on those conditions? Tell me, and tell me the truth. No, I wouldn't consent, the lawyer said softly. You have to be pretty hard and callous not to be affected by that kind of literature. Very effective. Would you put a world together like the one we're living in? Well, God is all good, and God is all powerful. He's powerful enough to have made a world where these sorts of things wouldn't happen. And if God is good, he's certainly better than we are, much gooder than we are, kinder, more compassionate, more holy, righteous, just. And if we would consent to making a world that's as lousy as this one in which we live, obviously God's goodness would not leave him consenting to it either. But what's his excuse? We couldn't help it. He could. And that's the argument, the problem of evil, the problem of suffering. Now we can be a little more philosophical about it. let me put it to you in terms of the syllogism. People will say, they may not be sophisticated enough to put it syllogistically, but implicitly, that soundbite criticism, how can you believe the Bible, even if there are miracles, how can you believe the Bible when there's an incoherence in the theology that's presented in the Bible? On the one hand, the Bible tells us God knows everything. So if he knows everything, he knows how to avoid this evil. Moreover, God is able to do everything. So what he knows about how to avoid evil, he has the power to perform. And on the other hand, God is good, and obviously he wouldn't want these sorts of things to happen. So if God is all-knowing, and God is all-good, and if God is all-powerful, then there shouldn't be evil. Certainly not the kind of evil we see. Unexpiated, excessive, on and on and on. But we do see that kind of evil, and therefore Christian theology is wrong. There's an inherent contradiction in the premises of Christian theology. So I'm going to first try to help you with the philosophical problem here. Whenever somebody proposes that they have a paradox or a contradiction within a system of propositions, one of the ways to escape the paradox is to propose another proposition by which the contradiction or the apparent contradiction can be resolved. Okay? And so if you only had the propositions that we were talking about, God knows everything, God's all-powerful, God's all-good, perhaps evil then does seem to be paradoxical, incoherent in terms of those propositions. And over again, when young people go off to college, they go to an introduction to philosophy course or a philosophy of religion course or actually in other courses not having to do with philosophy at all, they'll hear this from their professors. As though, well, of course, you can't believe in Christianity. Whatever other things you want to say about it, it's incoherent. And then people often will add to that the emotional strength of saying, how could you believe in God when people are being tortured to death in Rwanda the way that they are? How can you believe in God when we see terrible natural disasters? How can you believe in God when children are killed and tortured? I was on a radio program a few years ago that took as its format, it was the Dennis Prager Show, if any of you ever listened to that when Prager was doing this. He would ask a priest and a rabbi and a Protestant minister to come in, and then they'd throw out a subject of religious relevance to be discussed by the three representatives, and then they'd have call-ins. And I don't recall how I got into this, but at one point in the show I said something about adoring God. That was the phrase that apparently pushed somebody's button out there. I talked about adoring God, you know, and so this caller comes on the line and directs this question at me and says, I want to know how you can talk about adoring God. You know, what's the problem? Apparently he had been on a jury that week in Los Angeles and as part of the case against a child molester had to look at pictures of what had happened to this child. And he was disgusted by them. He said, everyone was. And he said, I want to know how you can adore a God that allows that to happen. Now, what would you say if you're in a situation like that? Well, this may surprise you. I wanted to run with the caller. That is, run the same direction with him. Because he didn't realize that he was actually supporting my Christianity, not arguing against it. He didn't know that. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to draw him out. And I said, that really makes you indignant, doesn't it? He said, yes, it does. How can you adore God the love of the commandment? I said, well, I'm indignant about that, too. I think we need to be indignant about that, and we need to play for keeps. What do you mean, play for keeps? I don't want this. I don't want people to say, well, listen, we're all animals on the face of planet Earth, and it's different strokes for different folks. Some people are happy being kind to children. Some people are happy tormenting and molesting them. That's not playing for keeps. That's too convenient. That's too easy. It's too subjective. We're going to play for keeps. We're going to be indignant about this. I said, so now, if God doesn't exist, what one animal does to another animal is morally irrelevant. So given your approach to the problem, you no longer have the right philosophically, consistently, to be indignant about child molestation. I asked him about where moral absolutes come from. He said, well, people choose them on their own. I said, if people choose them on their own, then they're not absolute, are they? They're not absolute because they're only as good as you want them to be. If I choose, let's say I choose Cocoa Puffs as the best breakfast cereal. Not likely being a diabetic, but I think that. So I choose Cocoa Puffs. Now, is that an absolute choice? Does that mean Cocoa Puffs is the best for everybody? No, because you might choose Frosted Flakes. Of course, if you really were interested in your health, you'd be eating a bran cereal or something. But I've learned these things. Point is, anything based upon human choice is not universal, not absolute. And so I tried to explain to the caller, by your own approach, you've made it impossible to be indignant about this. Because whoever did this child, guess what? He chose his moral standards too. And they just happen to be different than yours. But it's not fair. It's not what? In the atheist universe, there's no fairness about it. What happens, happens. What is. And there ain't no more. You can't talk about fairness or justice or righteousness or kindness given the atheist universe. And so let's go back to the problem of evil. If we have these propositions out here that make evil appear to create a contradiction, one way in which you can relieve that logically is by adding another proposition that resolves the apparent contradiction. You can't always do that. There are some genuine contradictions and incoherences. But in this case, we can add one. And it's not difficult to do at all. Here's the proposition. You want to write this down in your notes. Whatever evil exists has a morally sufficient reason for it. Whatever evil exists has a morally sufficient reason for it. Now you see how that makes everything consistent? Yes, evil exists. But now by this proposition, there's a morally sufficient reason. And if God is all good, then he has that morally sufficient reason. And if God knows everything, he knows that morally sufficient reason. So his refraining from exercising his power to keep that tragedy from taking place is not contrary to his omniscience, nor is it contrary to his good, omnibenevolent character. And so now there's no longer a problem of evil. Not a logical problem. This is an interesting aside. If you read the literature and the philosophy of religion, and especially if you read anti-theistic polemics, the problem of evil is set forth as this grand, logically deductive problem. There's no way around this. The theist is in a real bind now. Over and over and over and over again. Well, this last week, I did a 3-day seminar on the 2 books by Professor Michael Martin of Boston University. Michael Martin is perhaps the best-known academic critic of Christianity, at least at this time, in our generation. He's written a very thick book, 500 pages or more, much of it very technical philosophical argumentation. It's entitled Atheism, Philosophical Justification, and a smaller book, The Case Against Christianity. Well, in the book on atheism, I didn't bring it with me, I'm doing this by memory. Some of you were in the seminar. About a quarter of the book, is that fair? Maybe a bit more, is on the problem of evil. Now, when I first got the book and I saw that, I said, boy, he's going to really rip this one up, right? Going to go after this. And I know the answer that I ordinarily give. I want to find out if he comes up with that. And to my surprise, in the first part of the first chapter that deals with the problem of evil, he concedes what I just told you. He said the problem of evil is often presented as a deductive problem in logic. And then he offers the very proposition that I've given to you. And he said, this proposition resolves it. It is not a logical contradiction. Now, I told you, he's got over 100 pages on the problem of evil on the first or maybe the second page when he finally gets to it. It only takes him 2 or 3 paragraphs, and he resolves the problem. If God is a morally sufficient reason for the evil that exists, then there is no logical difficulty. So here you have the most advanced, at least intellectually sophisticated critic who's publishing material, granting it's no longer, well, it's not no longer, but it's not a problem in the way that people traditionally have presented it. He grants that if the proposition, God is a morally sufficient reason for the evil that exists, is true, then the problem of evil is not a philosophical problem. Well, then why did he go on to write 100+ pages about it? Stop and think about it. What would you do if you were an unbeliever at this point? And the unbeliever says, well, there's so much evil, how can you believe in God? And your comeback is, I believe that the evil that exists is a morally sufficient reason. What's the unbeliever going to do? You don't have to be sophisticated. You need no PhD in philosophy. You're going to say, well, what's the reason? Believe it or not, Michael Martin takes 125 pages to, in a very sophisticated, technical way, basically say, well, then what's the reason? And he gives what he calls an inductive argument, a probabilistic argument, that no such reason can be given, given the information that we have about the world and the excessive amount of evil and suffering and on and on and on. And it's tedious. Many of you will probably be glad you weren't in the seminar having to be drugged through all this stuff and to read all of it. But he goes through all these different arguments back and forth. He gets into very high-level logic, and he surveyed the literature. I give him credit for that. He knows the literature on this, and he's trying to be responsible looking at all of it. But at one point in his conversation, well, his discussion, pardon me, on this, he comes to the place where he says, well, now, what about the possibility that there's a morally sufficient reason, but we can't grasp it? You're going to love this. He then goes on to argue that it's highly unlikely that if such a reason exists, that we wouldn't be able to grasp it. Whoa, really? What view of God do you have? And then, lo and behold, it turns out, he makes very clear that he has what he ends up calling a restricted theistic hypothesis that he's testing. And he says, if you have expanded theism, and he means by expanded theism, not just the proposition that a God who is all good, all knowing, and all powerful exists, but you expand it with other theological premises. People do it differently, but such as the fact of sin, you know, and certain other theological premises in the Bible, day of judgment, and all that, and the character of God as being inscrutable. If you have propositions like that that expand your version of theism, then he says the problem of evil is resolved, even inductively. Because on this expanded view, which, by the way, he calls Orthodox Christianity. Isn't that interesting? If by expanded theism we have something like Orthodox Christianity, he says you can't say that it's likely we would know the reason for evil, because given that conception of God, given that conception of sin, then theoretically, whatever reason God has, one, he might not reveal, and we might not be able to grasp it if he did. Now, here's a real illustration of presuppositions at work. I told my seminar people, I said, well, close the book. It's all over. He's talked around it. But if I can boil it down, it's like this. The problem of evil is a real problem inductively, because we don't know what God's reason is. But, of course, on Orthodox Christianity, you might not know what the reason is, and that's acceptable given those presuppositions, and there's no problem there. I say, okay, well, then why are you writing the book? And he continues to go chapter by chapter. You know why? Because the logical fallacy is just a howling one. He's a professor of philosophy. He says, well, if you hold to expanded theism, then one of the implications of expanded theism is restricted theism, and therefore restricted theism, if it has this problem, expanded theism will probably be no better. By which he means, expanded theism will not make it any more likely that we can predict the reason. So we're right back to, if you don't tell me what the reason is, I refuse to believe that there is such a reason. And if you don't want to take it on my say-so, which is fine with me, it always is fine with me, you go out and you find the literature. I think you're talking about the most sophisticated opponent of Christianity in the philosophical world today, at least who is writing. And he tells you, finally, buried down in there, Orthodox Christianity's got an answer, but I don't think their answer is going to help, because you can't really predict what the answer is going to be. Yeah, but what if my reply is, I'm not surprised that we can't predict what God's reasons are? After all, God tells us his thoughts are higher than our thoughts and his ways higher than our ways. God calls on us to trust him on his say-so. I would add to this that given the incomprehensibility of God, if God were to somehow communicate to us in human language the reason for all the suffering, we might not understand it anyway. takes a lot of humility to admit that, and philosophers are rarely humble people. And maybe the next door neighbor that you're having this discussion with over a cup of coffee may not be humble enough either. But when all is said and done, you need to realize, given who God is, you have no reason to expect that you would understand this. Now, for years, I have been answering the problem of evil with essentially the defense that I'm giving you right now. And so it came as a pleasant surprise back in 1991, June of 91. A well-known writer, Robert Ringer, had an editorial in my local paper, the Orange County Register, entitled God and Evil. And he goes into the problem of evil, and he responds to the Time magazine article that had appeared in June of 1991. And those of you who read Time, I pity you, but I mean, those of you who read Time, it was the cover story. This major editorial about all the wickedness and suffering in the world. And he says the essence of the Time article is the age-old question, if God exists, why does he permit evil in the world? Lance Morrow, author of the piece, properly alludes to such perceived evils as Hitler's attempted extermination of the Jews, the Bangladesh cyclone, the plight of the Kurdish refugees, and Pol Pot's use of the Khmer Rouge to kill some 2 million Cambodians. The Time article thrashes over much of the same ground covered in Harold Kushner's book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Forced to reconcile his belief in God with his son's tragic death from the incurable disease, Rabbi Kushner arrived at the rather odd conclusion that God is all-loving, but not divine. He says, though I cannot begin to understand the pain that Kushner has endured, I am compelled to take issue with this position. To me, it is spiritual fudging to say that God is a good guy, but impotent. Playing with semantics is pointless. Either God is all-knowing and all-powerful, or he's not God. I really appreciate this. He just cuts through the stuff and says, don't give a semantic answer. You can rearrange your semantics if you want, but it doesn't answer anything, because now you're not talking about a being that's worthy of being called God. Then he says, Morrow gets at the heart of the matter when he paraphrases theologian Frederick Buchner in pointing out the dilemma that you can match any two of the following propositions, but never all three. God is all-powerful, God is all-good, terrible things happen. You can match any two of those together, but you cannot match all three. And then he says, in George Smith's brilliant book, Atheism, The Case Against God, can I give a little commercial here, do you mind? George Smith has written a book that's been very popular in atheist circles, this one that he's referring to. And in our tape catalog, you'll find that I have a radio dialogue with George Smith on the Jon Stewart show. You may want to look into that. He says, in George Smith's brilliant book, Atheism, The Case Against God, he states the dilemma in more detail. Quote, briefly, the problem of evil is this. If God does not know there is evil, he is not omniscient. If God knows there is evil but cannot prevent it, he is not omnipotent. If God knows there is evil and can prevent it but desires not to, he's not omnibenevolent, all good. To Smith's persuasive list, however, I would add one other possibility. God knows there is evil in the world, but doesn't choose to stop it for reasons that are beyond our understanding. Boy, that makes me feel pretty good. This is the sort of thing I've worked out after years of theological, apologetical, pastoral experience. And here's this guy in this article, without any specific Christian testimony, saying, well, no, wait a minute, there's another possibility. God has a reason that we don't understand. In other words, God alone knows why he does what he does. If God exists, he's unknowable and undefinable by human standards. Now, I don't like that sloppiness in theology. If God exists, then he is knowable because he can show himself in the way that he wishes. But our author goes a little overboard here. He says that's precisely what makes him God. In his Time article, Morrow states, quote, perhaps man is to God as the animals of the earth are to man. Can it be that God visits evils upon the earth not out of perversity or a desire to harm, but because our suffering is a byproduct of his needs? That's the end of the Lance Morrow quote. And our author says, well put. However, to extend this analogy and look at it in a slightly different light, consider this. Perhaps man is to God as a dog is to man, and a dog is to man as a flea is to a dog. That is, the man, the dog, and the flea, who are merely tagging along for the ride, have neither the faintest idea as to why their masters do what they do, nor the means ever to know. Now, I realize he's using anthropomorphic analogy here. That's an interesting one. Okay, the flea understands why the dog's going all the different ways he is. Every possibility the flea might come up with in terms of predicting the dog's behavior is not going to work, given the flea's logic. And the dog, the same way with respect to his master, you know? That's why we have dog psychologists now. I've actually read an article on that. You know, there's people who suggest that the reason dogs misbehave and they bark and so forth is because we have confused them and frustrated them. You know? We've given them to believe that they can expect this and this is what we want them to do and so forth. And then they end up acting according to that logic, and then they get, you know, smacked by us. And so they get all, you know, paranoid, psychotic, and so forth. Well, I mean, I think that's kind of a silly, overboard approach, but is there not some truth to this? I've had a dog. Maybe some of you have, you know, friends that have dogs. And here's what happens. One of the reasons you get a dog is that you want them to bark when strangers approach, right? So they'll be good watchdogs. They give you a head start in realizing someone's here or someone you don't want. Maybe even you want them to attack. And then what happens when a friend comes to the door and your dog stands there, whack, you know, barking away, and you keep saying, stop that, stop that. And I says, what do you mean you train me to bark at people when I don't know who they are? How am I supposed to distinguish between your friends and bad guys? So given the dog's logic, he can't figure out, why am I being treated like this? The flea can understand, why am I being carried around like this? It may not be philosophically sophisticated, but it's an interesting analogy. And so Ringer says, the question then becomes, is God indifferent to us as the dog is to the flea, or does he allow us to suffer for reasons we do not understand? When someone takes his dog to the veterinarian, the dog has no idea why his master allows pain to be inflicted on him. Isn't that true? I think so. In the same way, perhaps God doesn't always give us what we want, but he knows what we need. And though he's using a veterinarian example about a dog, that reminded me, again, an illustration that I use when I'm out on the road talking about the problem of evil. There was a day many years ago when my second son, David, fell off the kitchen stool and gashed his nose terribly. He was bleeding profusely. We ran to the emergency room, and the doctors had to put at least a couple of stitches in fast enough to keep him from bleeding anymore. And I had to hold his hand as they stitched his face without Novocaine. And he screamed bloody murder, and it broke my heart. Now, you all know why I did that. David's alive today and suffered no real terrible lasting consequences because we did that. Well, now, the picture makes perfectly good sense to you, doesn't it? But now, what if I describe only part of it? What if I were to tell you, you know, almost like confessing these terrible things in my past, and I were to tell you, there was a day once when I paid a man to stick pins in my son's face. And if that's all you knew, you might say, what a wicked, lousy, I'm going to take you outside and thrash you, poor person. What resolves the difficulty? Well, you realize you don't have all the information. When I say, at least given what we knew at the time, that was all we could do, salvage the situation. David was 2 years old. Do you think, by any stretch of the imagination, I could have explained to him as he was bleeding there, David, you're going to have to suffer intense pain for a few minutes, son, and this is the only way to save your life? A 2-year-old doesn't understand those things. Now, you may want to project adult logic on a 2-year-old, but I assure you that no amount of explanation would have made David stop screaming on the table saying, this is for my good, this is for my good. He was a child crying out loud. For all we know, we are children too. Doesn't the Bible tell us that we are children? John Calvin said, one of the most marvelous passages in the Institutes of the Christian Religion, that in the Bible, God lisps to his children. For all of the profundity of the Bible, no one has the intellect to match all of that. For all of its profundity, Calvin says, it's God giving baby talk to us. And so, if God exists, and I believe with all my heart he does, he can certainly be all-powerful and all-good and have a reason for the evil and the suffering that I undergo, even though he doesn't tell me, and even though, as a small 2-year-old, I might not even understand if my Heavenly Father said it's to save your life. And so Rare says, which brings me to the boldness of the humanist philosophy. Given that we do not know who we are, how we got here, and where we're going, by what brazen reasoning do we think we should be able to understand evil and suffering and thus make judgments about a supreme being? Again, he's not a transcendental presuppositionalist as far as I know, but he's right on the target here. He says, now let me turn it around. Given your humanist approach to things, you don't know anything about this world, do you? You don't know where you came from. You don't know the reason of life is. You don't know, you know, by what absolutes you should prioritize your life and so forth. Given your extreme degree of ignorance, by what brazen reasoning do you think you'd be able to understand evil and suffering and make judgments of God? Does this sound biblical to you? God put Job through a great deal, didn't he? And Job listened to his friends, well, not at first, eventually he gave in, and in his own way challenged God. He said, I've got some questions, I want answers. And God was very accommodating of that arrogance for reasons which are only gracious. God said, fine, Job, I'll answer your questions, but first I have some for you. And what does God do? He humbles Job's pride. He goes, where were you when I made the rock goats? Where were you when I made Leviathan? Where were you when I stretched out heaven as a span? Do you understand how I do all these things, Job? And when God got done, so now it was Job's turn, we find Job now has his hand over his mouth, and he says, I spoke too soon. That's the point. God said, if you could understand everything that I understand, maybe there'd be a place for me to answer your question. But you can't understand the most basic things of the natural world. It's as though God said, Job, to me, all this is a piece of cake. I can make heaven and earth. I can make, you know, the animals of this earth. I can make the most mysterious sea monsters. And none of that mystifies me. And you're totally baffled by all of that. And now you want me to explain something like suffering in the way I'm governing the universe. Job says, I spoke way too soon. No one can find out the Almighty to perfection. And so Robert Ringer, I think, again, has backed into a truth that is perfectly biblical when he says, you brazen humanist, what makes you think if the Almighty were to tell you, you'd be able to understand? You don't understand hardly anything in this world by your own admission. If God exists, surely he operates in a completely different dimension than we do. Thus, he alone knows his purpose. That's sloppy theology, I'll grant that, but I still like the direction where he's going. God doesn't operate in a completely different dimension because God has entered into our dimension, has made himself known and governs this world. But the point is, because he is transcendent and has no obligation to be part of our lives or our way of thinking, God can have reasons which he, one, does not have to give us, and two, if he did, we probably wouldn't understand. And so, Ringer says, therefore, even though Atheism, the Case Against God, is an undeniably brilliant book, its impeccable logic is rendered irrelevant if God does in fact exist. In other words, this is a great argument for disproving God's existence unless he exists. Which may remind you of something I said earlier. All of the unbelievers' arguments come down to that. You say, well, I can, that's right. This argument would probably show that God doesn't exist, unless, of course, he does. Because if he does, what you're bringing up is not really a problem. And so it says, this impeccable logic is rendered irrelevant if God does in fact exist. Why? Because Smith's logic is valid only in a secular dimension. A supreme being would transcend secular knowledge just as man transcends a dog's capacity to understand. And that's the answer to the problem of evil, friends. I can give it to you in a sophisticated philosophical form. I can preach a sermon about it, or you can listen to, as far as I know, an unbelieving author says, no, just look at the possibilities. If God exists, unbelievers can only at that point respond, well, then tell me what the reason is. I'm reminded here of C.S. Lewis and his life as it was portrayed most recently in the movie Shadowlands, which was based on a stage play earlier than that. Now, I know a bit about the life of Lewis, and I did see the stage play, and I saw the movie, and sadly, at every point, you get a watering down of what C.S. Lewis was like, you know. But even at that, I thought the movie was grand. And I noticed, by the way, we have some copies of 10 points back in the room, and I think we have a stack of them where Pastor Wagner wrote on the movie Shadowlands. Roger and I led a discussion in a small congregation that I preached to in Orange County about the movie Shadowlands, and I really had very little to add to what Roger had to say. Did a really great job. But what little I was able to say was to the effect that C.S. Lewis had a philosophical answer to the problem of evil. And because he had the philosophical answer, it was like he was able to lay out the boundaries on the playing field. He knew what was in bounds, what was out of bounds, intellectually and spiritually. He had the answers. He could give them as a verbal response. He could, if you will, give a reply to the critic. But then God inflicted such suffering and sorrow in his life that he almost gave it all up. And you can have the boundaries worked out intellectually because you know that there is an answer. But it's altogether a different matter to learn to trust God when he doesn't tell you why. And I still struggle with that battle. And by his grace, I still trust him. But I know that the reason why the problem of evil can seem so challenging to us is because even when you philosophically know that it's not a logical problem that can be used against God, we all go through experiences where our temptation is to say, God, explain it to me. I don't understand. And Lewis went through that. I know I've gone through it. My guess is you do go through it. The fact that it's an emotional problem or a psychological problem because God doesn't share with us the reason should not lead you to be intimidated in the face of the unbeliever who says, well, then, you know, why should you believe in God? You see, the problem is that the unbeliever says, if God doesn't explain the reason to me, I won't trust him. And you need to show people, even if they are not willing to bow at the end of the demonstration, you need to show people what's inherent in what they're saying. It's not that you're rejecting it, although you do, but all you want to do is explain to them what you're saying is, God, if you will allow me to judge you and you pass my test, then I will allow you to judge me. But you see, that's absurd logic, isn't it? It's like saying, God, if you will allow me to be God long enough for you to pass my test, then I will turn around and let you be God. And again, I only tell you, you should show this to the unbelievers so they know the nature of their reasoning. The unbeliever has every, at least psychological, you know, prospect and possibility of saying, yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way, and that's just exactly the way I'm going to keep it. I'm not going to bow to any God no matter what. I will remain the judge of this universe no matter what. So I guess you pointed out to me, I'll never be satisfied unless God is willing to not be God. But that's okay because I'm not willing to have any God. I mean, that is a possibility. But by the grace of God, if you point out the logic to people, they may realize, of course, what I've said is, in advance, there can't ever be an answer that I will accept because I'm never going to allow God to be God. Remember how Paul says, let God be true, though all men are liars? That's a presupposition of the Christian worldview. God has no one who judges him. We are in no position to do so. We're not intelligent enough to do so. And even if we weren't sinners and finite, God does not relinquish the throne of the universe so that we can stand in judgment over him. To put it as C.S. Lewis did once, God is not in the dock. The dock is where the accused stands in English jurisprudence. God is not in the chamber of the accused with us at the bench. So that once he explains why that child was molested, or why that war took place, or why there was torture, once he explains that to us, we'll take off the robes and step down and say, God, okay, you become the judge. C.S. Lewis puts it very well. The unbeliever doesn't understand. We are the dock. And when God graciously allows Job to cross-examine him, it's for the purpose of saying, Job, you forgot who you're talking to. The problem of evil is psychologically powerful. It is philosophically and logically irrelevant to the truth of the Christian faith. What you have seen in these five lectures, I hope, if I've been at all effective, is that in every case, though there is a good answer that Christians have about creation, about other religions, about the text of the Bible, about miracles, and even about the problem of evil, in every case, what does it finally come down to? What is your worldview? What are your ultimate commitments about reality, how you know what you know, and how you should live your life? And if I can convince you to stick with me for another lecture, we're going to finally deal with that last question then. Well, what do we do about these conflicting worldviews and these different presuppositions? If you come back, I'd like to talk to you about the mushy-mindedness of the quasi-atheist. Thanks.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.